Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show today. I'm very excited to introduce my guest, Kelly Ware, who is also from the Flathead Valley. She's just recently back from a big conference on permaculture that she's going to talk to us a little bit about today and her experiences gardening, and she's going to talk a little bit about an edible forest she built at her church, and just lots of fun gardening tips for us today. So she's also here in Montana. The Flathead's about 65 miles south of where I am. I'm up by the Canadian border. So welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thank you.
And that's kind of just a brief introduction. If you want to tell us a little bit more about, you know, your passions for gardening or how you got started and who you are and just a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I guess that I was influenced by my mother, who every year there was less grass for me to mow because she was always adding garden beds. To this day, she's 76 and she still adds garden beds. I have to beg her to stop. And I started my first garden when my daughter was born, and I lived in Moab, Utah, and I needed to grow some of my own food for just managing my finances. And I had been to, that was about 21 years ago, I had been to the Bullock Brothers farm up in Northwest Washington State, which was the premier place for interns to learn about permaculture. And I was absolutely smitten and became passionate advocate of all that I learned back then. And I've just been practicing it. I moved up here to the Flathead about 13 years ago. So I have a system that in parts of my yard resemble what Toby Hemingway calls an evolved ecology. So I really appreciate, especially in the last few years, what that feels like and what it looks like. And everybody says, oh my gosh, your yard, I'm so jealous. We're known as the house with all the flowers, because every season there's, you know, there's the red and yellow with the tulips, and then there's the yellow and purple bloom with the irises, and there's kind of this like firecrackers. There's these different stages throughout the spring and summer. So nice. I just kind of started. Very first thing we did when we got to the house is down in Plains, there's a great nursery that is very inexpensive called lawyersnursery.com. Oh. And we used to go to the Memorial Day sale every year and get trees and stick them in. And so I've had wonderful pears and elderberry and apples and apricot and stuff that comes from that, all of my different shrubs and everything. So it's really neat to have an older system.
Now, how big is your place in the fire? Are you just on a city lot, or are you out in the country a little more?
Yeah, I'm in a double city lot. I am on about 100 feet by 140. Mm-hmm. And it every year has less grass for the dogs to play in. And the kids, they can walk down to the school if they want to, you know, throw a frisbee or something. But I hate mowing. I make my husband do it. And so every year there is less yard to mow.
That's fantastic. I had some guests on, I think the week before last, the Organic Savage couple, who were talking about they don't like to mow. And so they've been doing the same thing, planting more perennials every year so that they have less grass to mow. And then I think it was Ben Capozzi, who I had on Friday, was talking about Toby Hemingway. So, but he didn't talk about that evolved ecology. So I'm a little curious to hear more about that. And then also, usually I ask a question about what is organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean, but maybe I'll ask you, like, can you tell us a little bit about permaculture and like, is there a difference between permaculture and organic gardening? Like how they differ maybe? Do you know or exactly what is permaculture for the audience?
It's a very big term. It's a very big book. Permaculture is basically a way to look at your situation and address it. So there are the principles of, well, the ethics, of course, are how earth care people care, and then a reinvestment of surplus back into the two systems. So in that sense, in the ethics, you're always reinvesting, say, your clippings back into your system or your mulch back into your system. The principles are, you like looking at valuing the margins. So you kind of increase your edge. You try to produce no waste. So everything in our house and our kitchen goes out into the garden. Okay. So through the permaculture studies, I guess I could say, I have run into a lot of tips and strategies and techniques that are adopted by permaculture in the way to make my area more ecologically friendly. One of the descriptions of permaculture is to see to your human needs while you build ecology. So in my yard, I've been really focusing on how to bring more elements into my system. And in a lot of ways, I don't think it differs from organic gardening, except that from the studies within permaculture to mimic, for the most part, how nature works, you try to not have your soil be bare. You're really doing more of a mulch-based system. And, you know, again, whenever my soil is bare, I'm really conscious to, you know, try to hurry and get things coming up and then mulch it as soon as I can. And so I don't really know. I know that organic gardening, you might till the soil. I don't till the soil anymore. If I want to plant seeds, I'll move the mulch aside and put the seeds in. Or I used to just scatter seed everywhere. And I've kind of come to the place where that's fine if I have a copious amount and I don't mind wasting a bunch of seed. But I had a ton of great kale seed and I shared it and I threw it everywhere. And then I had the next year was a really bad crop. I had a bunch of powdery mildew for some reason, and I had aphids, and it was just a kind of a funky year for my kale. And so I didn't produce much kale seed. So I kind of learned the lesson of just being a little bit smarter about just throwing seed everywhere. Although I still scatter seed with like clover and buckwheat and different kind of cover crop things. So I'm always trying to consider what can I bring into my system. I like to tell people about Jack Spirko and the Survival Podcast, put a little boon out for him, because I think if anyone's trying to have a resilient homestead or really into permaculture or into making their life better on several different levels and they don't listen to Jack, then they should take that opportunity to check out some of his programs. And it's just so diverse and it's so complete information. In fact, we joke at our house that our son is homeschooling with Jack Spirko.
Cool. So I was saying, so do you just spread the kale? I mean, you're talking about like putting it in a specific bed, right? I mean, or do you just spread it out?
I spread it out. I spread it out around everything. I use kale. I share it. We use it for everything. So kale is also another good cover crop. And I grow a lot of seed. I let it go to seed, or I'll start it in the fall, and whatever overwinters will go to seed in early summer. Mm-hmm. And I use it. I was taught by the Bullocks to just grab kale seed and throw it wherever I don't want the weeds to grow, or wherever I want to let kale be the significant weed. And I also scatter seeds, you know, different kind of clovers and buckwheat and Australian field pea and hairy vetch and stuff like that. I'm always kind of trying to build my soil through cover crops and several different other methods that I'm doing. And that's one of the things we'll talk about later, but that was one of the things that most hit me during the Permaculture Voices that was so cool. But a lot of people can either mix up their things all around, or for the ease of harvest, you can do things separately in a bed. I find that if I have kale in different places, some of it will get attacked and some of it won't. And kind of like they say in permaculture, you know, if something gets eaten by aphids, then A, it wasn't meant to be there, and B, all the aphids will be on that plant and they won't be on other things.
You know, I had a guest whose episode's going to air tomorrow, who was talking about he had aphids on some Shasta daisies and he kind of just let them sit there. And then the ladybugs came and ended up eating all the aphids anyway. And so those daisies just were blooming just a few days after all the other daisies. And it actually ended up bringing just more beneficials into his yard that way.
Yeah, I don't worry about it too much. If it starts to really bug me or it just looks bad, because they do lay eggs really quickly, and I'll cut the whole plant off and then just throw it in the garbage and let the aphids figure out on their own what to do. But I don't worry about it. You know, some people spray soaps and stuff like that. I'd rather just take the plant out, because if there's something, if the aphids are attacking something, it's either saying that there's not enough going on in the soil to support that plant, or the plant is too weak. And I've usually have an amazing ability to grow kale that doesn't have aphids on it. Usually in the middle of July or late July or the end of summer when it's been hot, all the kale will fall prey to aphids, but because it's weak, it's tired. Right. But I heard a tip about just cutting back the kale in July, kind of early July or mid July, and letting it regrow all fresh again. So, you know, that's a way to do it too.
Okay. I'm glad you're talking about that, because I'm going to try to grow kale this year that I've never grown before. Kind of getting into that green smoothie movement thing and putting more kale into my diet, which has never been one of my go-to foods or anything. And then one of my guests talked about kale chips and gave me some of those yummy kale chips. So,
oh yeah. And you know, a lot of times too, I'll dehydrate it and I'll powder it, so I have kale for my smoothies all winter long. I'll do the same thing when I go out and collect stinging nettles in the spring. I'll get about 4 big bags of stinging nettles and dry and powder that. And that's a great thing to have in your smoothies. In fact, one of the tips about green smoothies that I've heard from a raw food educator is that you really want to mix up all your greens, because your body you'll build up the alkaloids if you always use spinach or you always use chard or, you know, one thing or another. So you really want to diversify your greens about every few days, mix them up. And I used to have a booth at the farmer's market, and I specialized in a variety of different greens for green smoothies. And one of the best things to stick in your green smoothies, or even a diversity for your salad, is purslane. And a lot of people think it's a weed, or they throw it out, or they pull it out. But purslane, if you look it up, is so good for you, and it has so many benefits, and it's so great to stick in your green smoothies. And that's that thing that kind of looks like a sedum, that's the ground cover, and it's just fabulous. And it really you know, propagates from seed. And I had one permaculture property that I was on at my dad's ranch before we sold it that had a ton of purslane. So I'd harvest it and sell it at the farmer's market, and people loved it.
All right. Well, that's going to be something I'm going to have to try too. And so tell me, like, you just dehydrate the leaves and then just crumble them into a powder?
Uh-huh. Yeah. You just dry them, and then we have a Vitamix, and I just pull them into the Vitamix and whir it up, and then put it into a glass jar. And that's how I store, because, you know, it's such a bummer to have to buy a bunch of kale during the winter time at, you know,
and it's so expensive in the winter.
It is.
It's so expensive anytime you have to buy it.
It is. And I really love to, you know, the idea of different varieties. I love the dinosaur kale or the lacinato. I always figure out how to say that one. But that one's exciting. And there's also a perennial kale that I want to try to get into my system called sea kale. And it'll come up every year, and you can buy starts of that. So I really am trying to get more toward perennial food systems, which is another boon of permaculture. But I of course I still do all my diverse varieties of annuals, and I try to save the seeds for those.
Okay. Well, tell us a little more about your garden, like something that grew really well this last season. Was there something that grew especially well last year?
Well, I have always love the greens. I am a green person, and if I could just live on salads primarily, I probably would. I kind of am like a rabbit. So I brought, you know, actually I've saved seeds every year from the very first packet of musk-glun mix. you know, the seeds of change had, gosh, it was probably 10 years ago. And I used to have a red and a green type of Russian kale in my garden, and they've since mixed into a very soft version of a red kale, or a big version of a red kale. So it's really neat. I've actually created my own Kelly's kale. I always say if I had a farm, I'd call it Kelly's kale. But so that's fun. And I still have some throwbacks of different varieties that still stick around, a little curly and stuff like that. But of course, the greens do really well. My chard does amazing. It puts out really good amounts of seed. And it's so wonderful to give people seed packets. I'll usually make up for Christmas or, you know, a bazaar or some kind of a craft fair. One year we made it up and we took it around to all the neighbors. But I make up seed packets of early spring mixes to put in your garden, and, you know, calendula and kale and chard and salad mix. I save all my salad seeds and I just do it by hand. It's kind of like, instead of knitting, I clean seeds in late winter when I have a day or two to just watch a few movies and think about spring. I'll just clean seeds.
How fun. Mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of see how you do that more.
I just stick everything in a paper bag, and when I get around to it, I start to clean it. Yeah, there's a couple screens that you can do, and you shake it on the floor, and then you just sit there and you kind of toss it and blow it at the same time, or you can pour it from a metal bowl into a 5-gallon bucket when the wind is kind of blowing, and it'll blow the chaff through, and you just keep pouring it back and forth between, you know, like 2 5-gallon buckets, or when you're shaking it to get the main chaff off, you shake it over a sheet or something like that. And sometimes I'll just get the kids and we'll just stomp on it. It's really fun. We'll just go in circles around just stomping on it to get it all out of the pods. And it's fun. It's our cool. Good family event.
Nice. How about something that you want to try new this year that you've never tried before? Anything you're going to do different this year?
Well, I'm really excited about getting more into berries. My daughter's 21. She was a little baby learning how to sit up under fruit trees when I was grafting out at the Bullock's farm. And she said, "Mom, you don't have very many berries." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I just haven't spent the money investing." I always said, "Gosh, if I wouldn't buy a bottle of wine and instead I'd buy a perennial, like some berries." So I'm working on that plan now.
Okay, cool. Any berries, like in particular, like raspberries or blueberries? Or
we have a bunch of raspberries and blueberries, but I want to get into aronia berry and sea berry or sea buckthorn. There is, oh gosh, I've been doing some gooseberries, and jostaberries are awesome. They're kind of pokey, all those. The honeyberry is another new one. There is a really great source for sea buckthorn and honeyberry, and a type of autumn olive that, oh gosh, I'm not sure. I'm trying to come up with this other type of berry, but from Versaland, Grant Schultz at Versaland is the go-to place on some of these berries. He's got the best prices and the biggest plants, and they've all been inoculated with, you know, mycorrhizal or some sort of like King Stropharia mushroom on all of his trees and berry bushes that you can buy. And he sells a lot of things like pawpaws. I bought a bunch of seeds from him, so I'm kind of messing around with pawpaws and chestnuts and the American persimmon. I've got them all, trying to sprout in buckets. And so I'm kind of trying to diversify. I'd love to get into chestnuts and get chestnuts going up here. I think that they're an amazing nut. I've never tried them until I went out to Versaland. And gosh, if anyone gets a chance to go out there and see his operation and and what you can do on a large scale, he and Mark Shepherd are doing really great stuff on large scale acreage about what you can do between trees and also running animals and paddock shift system. So getting into larger systems, which is really where we need to go as a society.
Now, where's Versaland at?
It is in Iowa. It is near Iowa City, Iowa. And then Mark Shepherd's place is in Wisconsin. So they're very similar to us, maybe a little bit warmer, but he's still zone 5.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I planted way too many cherry tomatoes last year. I won't do that again. Some version of a like, you know, you get one of these seed packets. Actually, somebody gave us a couple flats of, or a flat of the same kind of tomato. And so all we had was this orange cherry tomato. And I won't do that again. I got cherry tomatoed out.
Mm-hmm. All right. How about something that you find is easy to grow and is generally successful every time? Would that be like your greens and your kales, or?
Yeah. And the perennial herbs, a lot of the, mm-hmm. you know, my comfrey grows like crazy, and comfrey I put around all the fruit trees because it really helps to feed the fruit trees. It's a deep nutrient accumulator. So it has a taproot that goes down deep through the roots of the fruit trees. And then it brings up magnesium and phosphorus, I'm thinking, potassium, anyway, for the fruit trees. And it's also a mulch producer. So you can cut it two or three times a season and you lay it down, and it's excellent for mulch. You can also make a compost tea out of it and put it around on all of your plants. And I do that every year. I make compost tea. Please do not let your compost tea go anaerobic because it's really stinky. So you don't want to do that. You just want to let it soak for maybe a day and a half, and then you just spread it around. It's really nutritious. And if you let it go to flower, the bees love it. So it's all around a great thing. And people are selling it online, like 5 roots for $20. It's a great crop to sell online because a lot of these systems, you know, that getting more into guild systems and more, I guess, independent of human systems, these permaculture food forests gardens are getting, you know, comfrey is considered one of the top 3 plants in the system.
So tell us more about the food forest you were saying that you planted at your church.
Well, I showed them some videos about what could happen. We had just finished the Sepp Holzer workshop with his initial project that he ever did in the United States here in Dayton, which, by the way, it's for sale, and it is a 92 acre, somewhere around there, property. And Sepp came and did these beautiful swales, and I mean 6-foot-tall hugel beds, and did about a 3-acre lake, and it's just gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous area. So you can find information about that site on Place of Gathering. It's called Place of Gathering. If you look up Sepp Holzer, Place of Gathering, it's really beautiful. So the church, I talked to them about how we could plant it and we could seed it, and the spring, the rains would come and it would pretty much grow it. And these trees, well, I didn't take into account that it was all sand. And whereas the Place of Gathering project ended up, you know, really growing sort of on its own, eventually they put in a sprinkler system on it. And the debate is, do hugel beds really need watering or not? And my answer would be that yes, they do, especially in the establishment phase of your systems. After a time, when they start breaking down, they probably don't. But I was on sand, and so every bit of water that fell on it went right through them. And so we did 3 very big hugel beds that were actually trenched. We dug a trench and put a bunch of old Christmas tree farm was getting rid of all of its stuff, so we stuck those in the trench and a bunch of other stuff and rotten straw and stuff like that. And then we put the soil down, the sod upside down, and then at least 1.5 feet of soil on top of that, sort of the subsoil. And so for 3 years, I have been doing seed mixes and kale and chard and radishes and basically just trying to grow the soil. We initially planted about 32 fruit trees. Everybody from the church donated $5 or $10 toward a tree. The kids made these cute little driftwood plaques with everybody's name next to the tree. And unfortunately, it was a tree sale from a nursery out of Oregon. And when they got here, I guess everybody who bought trees, more than half of their trees died. So we had some trees that survived, but not many. And then the next year I got in and I got some more trees put in there. So it's been one of these things where I was excited to do the project, and Dave Jackie in the Permaculture podcast by Scott Mann, called The Permaculture Podcast. Great, great series of podcasts. He's got about 250 podcasts on it. Dave Jackie talked about how, you can always go out there and plant a garden, but if you don't build the social capital behind it and the social structures behind it, it's no fun. I mean, it was really meant to be able to bring people into this beautiful, beautiful land and enjoy God's creation together, and almost start like a gardening small group where we could be of help to each other and minister to each other while we were out there gardening, which, it's always great to kind of do garden therapy and help people with, some biblical wisdom to get through their life. And it was very, very helpful for a couple of people who did spend some time with me in the garden and were going through very difficult life situations. It was really a godsend. But this year, going into third year, it's really a question of how to get more people involved, because the garden is absolutely so beautiful. We have a view of the Mission Mountains from it, and it's just absolutely beautiful.
Okay. Well, where is it located then?
It is on the northwest corner of Flathead Lake, actually not on the lake, but about a mile or two north. The road that crosses over the north into the lake is Highway 82, and it kind of runs into what's called Crossroads Church. And it's in this
Okay.
bowl down behind the garden, and it, like I said, it just has a view of all the Swan Range. So it's just north of Big Fork at Crossroads. Sometimes, let's see, there's a Facebook page called Hugelbeet, Hugelbeet, and on there I have a picture series of us building it. And we just got out there for a weekend with everybody, and we planted it and seeded it, and I came back a couple days to mulch it, and it just popped up green. My kids were amazed. She goes, "This, Mom, it was all sand, and now it's all green." And so, the miracle is there. The first year there was no irrigation system put in, and it got kind of, people were saying, "Oh yeah, Kelly's garden kind of died." But really, I'd go out there and I'd see what worked instead of what didn't work, and it was exciting because the comfrey was thriving and it was protecting the roots of the fruit trees. And I said, to the church staff, I said, "Guys, it's kind of like, God sees what does work in us more than what doesn't work in us." Just like the garden, you got to see what's working instead of what's not working. And what's not working,
I'll
you
bet
need
it's
to.
beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And this year, hopefully, we've gotten all the swales dug and it's all decked out. So this time it'll be more about putting the irrigation system. And I would like a drip line system because, you don't want to put plants in. Last year I put a whole fence around it so the deer wouldn't eat it and the trees, but you don't want to go through all that work and then just have to really worry in August. I mean, I've really been able to, with the rain that we have here and the mulch and the systems, I haven't had to water it until about mid-July, but then you really need to take care of it during August. There's been no rain here for 6 weeks during that time.
Right. And this could be a bad year this year. I mean, nobody ever knows what's going to happen, but the way
Yeah.
it's drying out already, it seems like we're.
But it was really cool. We had a big rain event and the swales filled up with water. And I said, "Oh, it's working," So it was really neat to see stuff that swelled out and really filled up versus what would have been just runoff.
Right. Cool. So. How about something that you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in our climate? Like, is there anything that you would say, I wouldn't try that, I haven't had success with that?
Yeah, corn and blueberries. Corn, because we have really alkaline soil and you really need a lot of nitrogen. And I've anytime I've ever grown corn, the season's really short. And I know some people are really good corn growers and kudos to them. And
Right.
we did get some of the corn that was grown at, it's like this, I think it's called jewel corn, rainbow jewel corn, and it's from the dry lands of more eastern Montana. And we ordered some of that, and that did fine if you want, not sweet corn, but so yeah. And Blueberries do not like alkaline soil, and we're very alkaline around here. And they need about a gallon of water a day. And I kind of have a garden that I try to train it to survive on neglect, thrive on neglect. And if you, it's kind of like I, here in the city, I have to pay a big water bill for city water. And at the church, they have a sister church in Africa. Granted, it's Rwanda, Africa, so it's more moist probably than we are here. But it's kind of like I always want to find what works without an irrigation system. And when I have to water stuff here, I just basically water it. I pride myself on only having to water maybe 5 times all summer. And blueberries hate that, and they hate my alkaline soil. So I'm about ready to just scrap them and go for service berries because they're kind of like a blueberry berry
Sure,
variety,
sure.
but they're much more productive and they're native to this area.
How about your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Would it be watering, or is there something else that just, you just got to kind of force yourself to do that you don't really like to do?
Probably deal with my quack grass. I found that there was freedom in a serrated sickle, and I tell everybody. In fact, anytime I get any extra cash, I order about 10 serrated sickles off of Amazon. You can get them for about $7 each, including shipping. They're only $3 if you can figure out how to get them shipped to you in bulk, but they always tack on $3 for shipping. But the Japanese serrated sickle, or it's also called a kama, Kama, is this little handheld sharp serrated sickle. And I have quack grass or crab grass, and I have bindweed, or I always call it morning glory, but really bad in this area. And whatever herb, I've taken out 2.5 acres of knapweed in 8 hours with my serrated sickle. I just would go out and have a little exercise and do, 4 days of 2 hour stints, and I'd take out the knapweed right when it was flowering, and it usually kills the plant when you do that and takes away the seed bank. But man, if you don't have a serrated sickle and you're pulling weeds, it's no fun. But what I've found is that I can let my grasses grow up pretty tall. And then I can just get in there with the serrated sickle. And so now I even look at my crabgrass as it grows tall, going, oh, I'm growing some really great mulch because I don't have to buy someone's straw that's been sprayed with pesticide or herbicides. And because I just stopped buying straw because it's so hard to find organic straw. And if it's not organic, it's chances are it's been sprayed with herbicides. So yeah, I just even the morning glory, I'll let it grow a little bit and then I'll just roll it back like a carpet and then I use it for mulch on top. And I fell in love with morning glory for the first time once I got that serrated sickle because you realize that it's a deep nutrient accumulator, which is a key element in your permaculture guild, because it has a deep taproot and it's bringing minerals from down deep and displaying them on this and providing them on the surface. So those are. And I know people aren't maybe familiar with the guild system. So we look in permaculture as you have maybe your overstory tree like a nut, and then you have your understory like a fruit tree, or then a dwarf fruit tree, and then some berry bushes under that. And then you want to have a nitrogen, you want to have nitrogen fixers in your system feeding your trees and plants. You want to have deep nutrient accumulators. That's something with a deep taproot that brings stuff from down deep and puts it on the surface. You want to have mulch producers so that when you cut it, you can lay it down and provide nutrients as it breaks down. You want pollinator attractors, things that'll bring, so that you're always, it's good to always have great flowers in your system to bring in different kinds of pollinators. And I think that's basically it. You want to maybe even grow a vine, like a grape at the base of your fruit trees, and they'll just vine up and use your fruit trees as support. That's how traditionally it was done in Afghanistan and a lot of countries. They would just plant all their grapes at the bottom of their fruit trees. And they're like the Siberian pea shrub is something that I have all over my systems, so that, and I have them between all my fruit trees. So it's a nitrogen fixing tree, and I do the chop and drop. It's a coppice tree, so that when you cut it, it'll regrow. And I throw down those nitrogen and fast, the little leaves on it are fast to disintegrate and feed the tree and provide mulch. And the nitrogen fixing trees are really good to grow your vines up them, your grapes or passion fruit or whatever in your climate you can grow. But that's how you can get nitrogen fixing trees into your system without necessarily taking away from a fruit tree if you grow your grapes up it.
Wow. Well, Kelly, that was a huge pile of information. I almost feel like you're speaking like a different language or some kind of scientific thing that I haven't heard, but I am so interested and so curious. And I think my, our listeners are just gonna really take this and want to go research it and learn some things and see how this all works together. I mean, it just sounds fascinating. And especially it hits home with us because we have struggled with water at my house. We just had a very shallow well until 2 years ago. We finally dug a deep well. It's the first time we've ever really been able to irrigate was last season. And so we've always struggled with water issues, but so it's nice to hear these different ways to grow. And then the knapweed, I am definitely going to look up one of those sickles.
Oh yeah, I give them to everybody for their birthday or for Mother's Day. And it since it's a cheap gift, it's $5 to $7. It is great, and I think that somebody could make a killing trying to sell these things at the farmers market. You could sell them. I've sold them at different fairs and stuff. People are like, "Oh my gosh, I've tried to look for these. Nobody sells them." And so you'd sell them for $15 easily at the farmers market, I think.
Well,
And I was
okay.
just gonna.
And but something that will get rid of knapweed like that, like, is so valuable. Like, I was even just talking to a realtor this morning about a huge knapweed problem and what was it, thistle down by the reservoir that they're having, and he's like on the weed commission or something, the weed committee up here, and was talking about they're gonna have to go into the subdivision that was recently built and talk to the homeowners association about getting rid of the knapweed and the thistle down there this year, because he said you couldn't even walk through this one field. So,
Yeah, in a
and they were talking about the different options. He was saying there's somebody in Whitefish that has like a really nice environmental option, but of course it's more expensive and trying to come up with those solutions. So I wonder if this is something to look into.
well, there are two things I'll say about that. It's well, three. They're doing a lot of research. A lot of great stuff comes out of Australia and New Zealand because they have drought issues and fire issues, and they've also had their gasoline has been $5 a gallon forever plus,
Oh.
and they've come up with innovations, and they've come out with the best solution for things like thistle is to steam them. So they're using big steamers and getting rid of it that way. The knapweed, biological controls are great with that beetle that they use. And the three ways to get rid of invasive species usually is with enough water or enough mulch or shade. And that's one way also to kind of cut down on your knapweed. But basically it's if you have it in your system, if you can just get alfalfa, if you can get hay, like spent hay, and just dump it everywhere that you don't need to have anything growing for a little while. Or don't ever forget the power of black plastic, and that now is a good time to put your black plastic on any area that you want to kill weeds, and it'll be ready, the ground will be totally ready, and the worms will eat everything underneath it and just make it awesome. You can add a little extra worm castings for bacteriological help, and by the time you're ready to plant in May, your soil will be totally perfect for doing that. One of the big things that I learned at Permaculture Voices from Dr. Elaine Ingham, which if anybody has the ability to take her online course, she's one of the foremost soil scientists in the States and probably in the world, and she does a lot with these compost teas, these brews that you have to get a bubbler and you make sure it does not go anaerobic and it stays aerobic, and you put like some manure and the little bit of the entrails of an animal, and basically you get this highly aerobic bacteriological spray. I'm not sure, you can look it up online for the exact recipe and how to do it, compost teas. but they're able to spray it on the soil and on the plants at different times, totally resist powdery mildew and all this kind of stuff. But what they found was that weeds did not grow if there was a presence of really good soil bacteria. And that was just eye-opening to me because I realized that, you know, if you don't have certain species in there, they're simply not in your system. So first thing I did is when I came home from Permaculture Voices conference, I also spent time listening to Paul Stamets, which he has a book called Mycelium Running: How Mushrooms Can Save the World, and he's just a phenomenal scientist on the power of fungi and mycelium. And so the first thing I did when I came home is I got on Amazon and I ordered beneficial mycorrhizal combinations. So I think this one that I got had five different really beneficial types of fungi. And I just got out there today, actually, and I sprinkled it all around my garden because I've been getting free wood chips. You can call up your local power company and they will usually deliver wood chips for free. And I've gotten already this season, I've already gotten four loads of wood chips for free that just they dump off. And I put them all around my yard. And last fall, well, for the last 3 years, I've collected bags of leaves in the fall when everybody puts them out. I just go around in my truck and I hijack them all. And I brought in probably 80 bags of leaves, and I put them pretty heavy on all my gardens. And then I put that mycorrhizal combination, and also there's something called horticultural molasses, and that is literally it's a fermented molasses that comes from beets. And while people say, "Oh, well, aren't the beets GMO?" Yeah, but when they ferment it, somehow it's like not, and when it breaks down, when it feeds your bacteria, it's not an issue. So anyway, I sprinkled that all over, and then I put the wood chips over my leaves so that as the rains come, it's going to soak up all that moisture, and the worms are just, I hate to even put a shovel anywhere in my yard because it is so thick with worms. I've cultivated billions of worms, plus anytime the kids don't finish off worms when they go fishing, they stick them in the garden. And so I got some pretty scary looking night crawlers too, but they get the red wigglers in there. Red wigglers are great for doing really all the work in your garden. But you know, I think we're going to actually put this house on the market, and somebody's going to inherit a phenomenal garden that is completely wood chipped, basically weed free, completely inoculated and fed. And you know, basically they're going to be able to start their starts and plug them in, and it's going to be beautiful because, you know, with such thick mulch, you just won't have a problem having to water so much. And you know, that's really what you want, to get your mulches thick enough to where you don't have to water. And the best place to store rainwater is in the mulch in the soil. Better than even in ponds or something like that. And you really want to get away from well water because it has so many minerals and salts and stuff like that. And your plants don't like it as much, and city water they don't like. So you really want to come up with systems to feed your plants on rainwater.
So what, gosh, there was so much there, but I'm just gonna go back to my script. What's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Let's see. I like to get out with my sickle. I like to harvest. You know, I guess it's kind of like where do we interact with the garden? And one of my favorite things that I love to do is I love to dehydrate and make seed crackers and seed cookies, because I actually used to sell these at the farmers market, and you can look up online seed crackers or seed cookies, and they're part of like the raw food industry. But they're really popular these days because so many people are intolerant of gluten, and everybody's looking for gluten-free solutions. And this is a great way to preserve everything that comes out of your garden without having to can. And my husband's the canner and I'm the dryer. So I take a big steel bowl and I grind some flax seeds, or I soak flax seeds for a couple hours. I soak sunflower seeds for a couple hours. And I'll grind those up in a Cuisinart, and then I take those big, huge zucchini that nobody wants, and I'll grind those up. And so the basis of my crackers are that. And then I can take any direction I want with what I have available in the garden. So I get all my herbs. I throw in anything that's growing. I harvest a ton of kale, and I grind that up because you can't really taste the kale when it's in there, but you get this good dose of chlorophyll and minerals and stuff like that. So anything green that's edible, it goes in. I even found a great recipe. I didn't find it. I invented it, which I was so happy about, which is if you mix your flax and sunflower seeds and zucchini and then pears, because I have these beautiful pears that come off my trees. I have Bartlett's, and I have so many pears. I'm trying to come up with all these recipes. And when you put that just little bit of sweetness in with your zucchini flax crackers, they are phenomenal. And you put tuna on that or some avocado on that. So I love, as soon as I have the ability to start making any kind of seed crackers, and I make them, and I'll just store them in big bags, and all throughout the year. In fact, I took bags and bags of chips or of the crackers to Permaculture Voices that I made last fall, and you know, we all ate those, and somebody got some avocados, and that was a couple dinners for a few of us. So
Nice.
yeah, so it's
I
neat.
bet
So
they'd
I think
love that.
that's. Yeah, and I love going and clipping. I'm always starting another hugel bed somewhere. Hugel beds are beds that you can kind of trench out your topsoil, and then you start throwing in all your lawn clippings and tree clippings, and you put the bigger stuff on the bottom and kind of work your way up, and then you put the soil back on top. And it's just a way to do some long-term soil building, and it really turns all of your scrap stuff into soil and makes a use for it, so you're not just sticking it in the back alley and forgetting about it. So all of my yard has been transferring into these little kind of in-ground hugel beds that end up being just about a foot or two high, but you know, they make it easier so I don't have to bend over. I'm 46 now, and I've, you know, had my share of skiing and biking and yoga injuries, and so it's great to lift my beds up a little bit higher.
Nice. So my next question would be, you know, what's your favorite tool? Is that your favorite tool, your sickle, or is there something else? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without? Is that it, or?
Yeah, that's for sure. That, and I went to Walmart and I got the biggest clippers they had for like tree trimming. And you could trim something that was a two inch thing, and it kind of has these gears on it. I think it was only $24 or something like that. But I've always gotten tree trimmers that just aren't big enough for the job, and then I end up hurting myself. So I just went for the biggest one that they had, and I love them, and I can clip anything. So now I actually kind of look at my trees and I think, oh, how can I make better bird perches? How can I, you know, open up that tree a little bit? So I actually start looking around to where I can get supplies for my next hugel bed, and I start clipping my trees, and it's good for your trees to kind of clip them back
Yeah,
sometimes.
that was my guest yesterday, or that will be on tomorrow's show. I think I talked to you yesterday is a fruit pruner, and he was talking about that, and opening your trees up is really important for their growth.
Yeah, I'm looking at my elderberry right now, and it's getting way too tall to harvest. And I'm gonna take it down. And boy, they said that elderberries you can just stick right in the ground and they'll start growing again. So I'm gonna try that with this new rainstorm. And yeah, those and willows and dogwoods, you can just stick them right in the ground and they'll regrow. But there's a really great propagation course that the Perma Ethos, which is one of Jack Spirko's groups that he started. They're doing a plant propagation course online, and so I've been giving all these ideas when my tax refund comes back about how to buy my intermittent mist system and get my beds of sand and biochar and vermiculite, and start putting my cuttings in that so I can start my nursery.
All right. So then my next question is a favorite internet resource. Would that be it? What was that again? Tell me that one more time.
That's called PermaEthos, and that is an
PermaEthos.
online permaculture design course that you can that it's very inexpensive. I think it's $300 or something like that. And the plant propagation course is $300, but it's great. You have it. Once you have it, you've got it forever. And these guys are just doing a great job. They might be doing another permaculture design course this fall online, and just the way that they're setting up stuff. But yeah, I listen to Jack all the time, and he's just so diverse, and people call in with all kinds of questions, and he's got an expert panel, and he's just so knowledgeable. He's been doing it for 6 years, has over 1500 podcasts, and we love him. He's really getting into ducks and does a lot of education. He's got this thing on YouTube called the Duck Chronicles, and we'd like to go into ducks because I'm allergic to chicken eggs, and I think a lot of people are realizing how allergic to chicken eggs they are. And I heard a great talk about this guy this week. He had on was called 50 Ducks in a Hot Tub, about how, you know, not to take calcium supplements because they're really toxic to the liver unless you're taking K2 with it. And duck eggs and duck meat are one of the only food sources of K2 to help your body metabolize calcium. So I'm looking forward to having duck eggs in my life because I miss eggs, and duck eggs taste so much better.
Okay. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or blog or website that you really like besides those ones?
You know, I hate to say it that I'm one of those people that gets all their news from Facebook, but it's true. There is a wonderful site, depending on what your interests are. There are a lot of really great contributing places on Facebook, and one of my favorite is called Regrarians, REGRARIANS, like agrarian, but regrarian, like restoration agriculture. And Darren Doherty, there's just a lot of that with keyline design. I think that anybody can that should find out about keyline design. That's basically how to capture water on a little bit more on larger landscapes, but you can still apply keyline design to any size. It's something that I think that all of our representatives should be studying. We should be going to the tribes and educating them about keyline design, because it's really about how to capture water slightly off contour so that you can run water out to the dry areas from where it collects. And so anybody who's got any kind of acreage whatsoever, K-E-Y-L-I-N-E, keyline design or Regrarians or regenerative agriculture, that's kind of my favorite. There's so many great books. Chelsea Green Publishing has a great list, and Permaculture Magazine out of the UK is really good. And Permaculture Voices is, I tell everybody, if you want to make more money on any possible aspect, please go to permaculturevoices.com and look at their podcasts, and then look at the show notes under that. Just all these people that he brings on have all kinds of ways to start making money, whether it's through large systems, small systems, fermenting bees, you name it. He's got amazing, amazing people on there.
Wow. Okay. I'll definitely have to check that out. And, those are all great resources. I love Chelsea Green Publishing. Some of their books are some of my favorites for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to talk about Facebook, because I have a feeling a lot of people are like, what, Facebook? You know, so many people are down on Facebook, but I just love it. And I think it's a great place to meet people who have the same likes and interests and are just a lot more, have a lot more things in common than you do. And I mean, certainly for podcasting, it's been an incredible resource for me. I mean, this podcast wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for my friends on Facebook and that have helped me launch and figure out the technology issues. I think it's important to share that as a resource. And I like the way you shared specific groups too. So that was nice.
Yeah. Anything in the permaculture department is great. There's Permaculture Educators and Permaculture America. I have Permaculture Montana. So if anybody in the Montana, Canada area wants to post anything going on, then they can join that or find out kind of more of a local scene. We also have Permaculture in the Flathead, and they're a new group. And I really think it brings us together. I find that people in the, organic movement, or, you know, there's a lot to do on the mycelium or fungi or medicinal mushrooms, you know, that whole, there's a whole other, you know, subgenre of people that are really interested because fungi are really the missing element too in all of our farming systems. And, And especially, just a thing about Roundup too, it kills the mycelium of the soil. That's why wherever you've put Roundup, your soil is flat because it really does damage to the mycelium. But anyways, yeah, I think that Facebook is awesome because it's bringing us together in ways that normally we wouldn't, and we're able to share so much information and really become aware. And I think sometimes it's more important than my email box. So, and it's really brought me together with people from all over. When I came out to Permaculture Voices, I met up with a great group of people from Mexico. And I guess I'm always dreamy about trying to get out of the Flathead in the wintertime. And so over Facebook, I've met friends from Belize, and we're kind of scheming and planning, how can I get out of here in the winter, like in the
And
Navajo.
they're probably thinking, oh, I want to come see your snow.
Yeah, or in the summertime, they can come up and we can start, doing the swap, the north-south
Right?
migration.
And the nice thing about Facebook is if you are going to conference, then you don't show up there alone. You've already met a few faces, you've made a few contacts. It just helps build your network and make going to conferences not so, alone or scary. And that's the big thing. It seems like these days people are, it seems like to me 2015 is the year of the conference and networking in person after everything. And so I think
Yeah.
Facebook's a great way to connect that way too.
Yeah, I want to put a plug out there for anybody in this area in Montana, or anybody that's within a couple days driving distance. We're going to have an ecological summit at Sage Mountain that one of our friends, Zachary Weiss, is doing. He has Perpetual Gardens, and he's been doing a lot with the half underground greenhouses and just doing a lot of stuff. And he's getting great people to come out, and that's going to be like June 14th to 23rd or something like that. And it's going to be very hands-on experiential learning, and being able to check out some of these people and their work ahead of time is great. So
Right.
the ecological summit.
All right, I'll try to put link. I'm going to try to put links to all these things in the show notes page.
Oh,
So,
good.
so far that's been going pretty good. I found everything all my guests have talked about. So, okay. So then, my final question I ask: if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would that be? Like, is there a charity or an organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action, or what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either like locally, nationally, or globally? Like, what would make a greener planet for you?
Well, there's a interview, another great podcast channel that I listen to a lot. Well, I already said it was the Permaculture Podcast by Scott Mann. He had a gal in there from Canada, and she said that up in Canada, they've already made it illegal for pesticides to be sprayed. And I know that like, what do they call it? Like, when it's just for your lawn for looks, that's illegal. So you can't even buy pesticides anymore, and herbicides. And I thought, gosh, if they can do it in Canada, and there's also a recycling law, and that mandatory recycling when possible, something like that. And I just thought, these are things we could be doing here. So I've always had this. I've always had. I think that more work with trying to pass laws or being lobbyists for ecological change is important, because I talk to so many people with the legislature, and they say, well, I listen to these other guys lobbying all day long. Where are your lobbyists? And I think that the biggest thing that we can do is, this is set up, this country's set up as a republic, so that we elect people to represent us. Well, if we're not communicating with them, then how can they represent us? So I would really love to see something similar to a cease and desist on toxicity. While that wouldn't really be possible in this day and age, there is a law that I just posted on my Facebook that the chemical companies wrote for sort of like an oversight to chemical laws, and it's awful. I mean, there's somebody can come up with a new molecule, and they don't have to test it against the environmental, how it responds in the environment or how it breaks down. I would love to see people going after pharmaceutical companies in being able to keep their pharmaceuticals out of the water streams, which they can't. So then they need to change their pharmaceuticals to be more ecologically like they say, Ritalin and stuff like that has a 5,000-year shelf life. You know, what do we do with all these estrogens going into the ocean? What do we do with all the chemotherapy drugs? Somebody said their dog was on chemotherapy and they went out and peed on the grass, and everywhere it peed, the grass was dead. So what's that doing to our water systems? And so I
That's
want
crazy.
people going after the pharmaceutical companies where it comes to our water systems. And making laws that things need to be recycled if possible. People, cities and governments, they need to set up better recycling systems and curbside recycling. We don't have that up in this area. And so I just think that the more our voices are heard, the more it's going to make a difference. I don't necessarily think voting makes much of a difference, but I do think, you know, calling senators and keeping up on bills and making your voice heard and showing up at legislative sessions is, I think it's pretty big, especially the more you write the letters. You know, the squeaky wheels get the grease. So how much are we doing to make lasting change? I'd love to see human manure composting be legal. I'd love to see rainwater catchment stop being illegal. I mean, what kind of a unconstitutionality is that for capturing rainwater being illegal? That's ungodly.
But see, that's where voting counts, because you don't want to vote the people that are going to come up with those laws in there.
Well, I don't have faith in hardly anyone that we vote in, but it is
right.
Important to educate them while they're in office. And what they do say is that nobody who gets into office, even as well-intentioned as they might be, nobody can make a law unless it has public support first. So they can't go in there and change the system. There has to be public support. And I always love this quote by, I think it was Ayn Rand. I think it was one that my dad passed down to me. And it said that only through greed will we save America, because only when the consumer becomes more educated about what it wants will the market change. And you know, we have to start being a bigger voice.
Absolutely. I love everything that you said there. I mean, it's so true. Like, people don't realize. They think, oh, what I say doesn't matter. If I write a letter to the editor, it doesn't matter. But it does matter. You know, those politicians are collecting those things. They have people on their staff that are clipping out those letters to the editor. They do need to hear. If they can want to put something through all they want, they can want to pass a bill. But if it doesn't have public support, like you said, if it doesn't have people lobbying for it, it's not going to go anywhere. And that's one of the reasons people want to live in America, is because we do have a say and we can make change, but have to stand together and we have to be educated about what, you know, what the truth is and what we want to see.
Right. And
you're definitely a very educated. I mean, you have shared so much incredible knowledge today, and it just inspires me to learn more, that there's so much more out there that I have no idea about or that I need to learn more about, and different solutions that we could be using here, especially, like I said, with our water shortages that you've shared with us.
Yeah, I'm welcome anybody to join me on Facebook at Kelly D. Ware, as in Diane, and also Permaculture Montana. And I have a site that I'm trying to get going called permaglobal.com. And I also have the Facebook page, and I'm trying to get a podcast up, maybe with your help, Jackie.
Oh, yeah.
But it'll be in Spanish, more for trying to get this information out to the Latin world and possibly in English too. I can talk in English. I recommend, if anybody is afraid of talking, that they go to their local Toastmasters and start learning how to speak.
That's how we connected through Toastmasters.
Yeah, it's been helping me. I love my Toastmasters group. And Joel Salatin says the same thing. He's another great person to study and watch his videos if you ever want to get into raising animals in a very good way. And yeah, I think it's so important that we speak up. And I put the senators, whoever's my representative, I put them on my phone so that when I have an opinion, I just call them up and I tell them. And I've actually had Tester, you know, write back and mm-hmm. tell me how much they appreciated my comments of what to do with Montana forest lands that have been affected by the beetle kill, you know, in ideas that have something to do along the lines of the key line design and doing stuff on contour to stop the erosion and replanting and all that food forestry stuff.
They do. Those are great suggestions. I had our senators and congresspeople on my phone for a long time. I think back when I change phones, maybe I didn't move those phone numbers, but I, you know, it is easy to call and they do appreciate that. And when you, clog their lines about an important issue, you know, they note it. And, you know, one thing about being in Montana is we do have a little more access, I think, to our congresspeople than most people, but we need to take advantage of that as Montanans. Sure.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because we think, oh, we're just in Montana. We're just kind of up in the middle of nowhere.
I think it's the opposite. I think we have more power.
Yeah, we do have. We have a lot more ability to be representative. And I there was some Google thing that went around that shows how many times people Google things. And Montana was fourth in the amount that people were Googling about permaculture. So we're pretty hip. Even California was number 27, all those people. And you'd think that with the drought, they'd be wanting to learn how to be more ecologically sound and how to do rainwater capturing and earthworks and all that, which is part of the permaculture study. And so, yeah, we're number four.
All right. Well, I've always thought Montanans were pretty progressive in their own way.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, did you want to leave us with like an inspirational tip or a quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Yeah. You know, I want to tell people to, you know, if they want to start their garden, just build up, you know, just look into something called sheet mulching. Don't worry about digging your grass out. Don't worry about killing grass. Don't worry about spraying stuff. Just start building, just start adding. It's kind of like, more you do to add to it than to take away or to, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice. Well, thank you, Kelly, for being my guest today and sharing just so much valuable knowledge and resources for people to look into and just making so many options possible for people that probably didn't even know a lot of these things existed and just being very inspirational.
Thanks, Jackie. I want to just say one last thing that I really tell everybody, and it's really about making your backyard like a Noah's Ark. The more you can bring diverse species, even if you just have one or two of those different kinds of fruit trees or whatever, we've come to such an amazing opportunistic time in our history of. We have the most amazing plants that have been developed. We have the most amazing fruits that are really tolerant to your area, or that you can even push the zones a little bit more. So say it's a zone, you know, 5 tree and you're in zone 4 or whatever. You can kind of try different things and try different microclimates to be able to bring in the most diverse amount of edible species or medicinal. And, you know, look in terms of food, fiber, fodder, fuel, and pharmaceuticals and into your system. So if you can just along these lines, if you can just really start to be a collector of species and take any little extra funds you have and you know, get on some of these really great nurseries like Rain Tree Nursery and yeah, I mean, there's so many Oikos, there's so many great nurseries, Bob Wilson, and I mean just amazing resources for species, because I always think, you know, there might be someday when you can't get that apple tree from Wisconsin. Later I found out that was some ancestral thing from my ancestors had apple trees in Wisconsin, but I always say that, didn't know where it came from. But just try to be like a Noah's Ark in your own backyard, no matter how big it is, and then from there you can propagate species and you can share them with your neighborhood. And the newest, greatest field to go into is the organic nursery business, about really useful and beneficial species.
All right. Well, thanks, Kelly, for sharing everything today. And I'll put the links to you and everything you've shared with us in my show notes. So if people go to, I just tell everybody go to awesomemontana.com and click on the links for Mike's Green Gardens, probably the easiest way to find us. It'll all be there.
Great. So, thank you so much, Jackie, for everything that you're doing. You're really making a difference in the world.
Thanks, Kelly. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com. Like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you'd head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get found by other listeners and share the knowledge. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day.